Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and we're going to continue with our kind of unplanned episodes on COVID. We did one a few days ago, kind of an overview. We had the privilege of talking to Dr. Nocotti, who's in Italy. So we got to learn a little bit about what they're going through and what we can learn from that. And what we want to focus on today is the management of the airways primarily in these people. And so I have with me one of our fantastic faculty here at Johns Hopkins, who has been very involved with developing our approach to managing the hypoxemia and the airway management in these patients as we see them here and in developing guidelines that are certainly being shared and used across quite a wide area as he works with people in different institutions. So Dr. Alexei Pustovoitow, who is a great colleague and really involved, I'm so pleased to have you on the show. Thank you for coming.
Yeah, thank you, Jen.
So I want to just remind everybody that due to COVID, the live in-person ACRAC podcast that we were going to have on April 24th is being rescheduled for another time. Once hopefully we get through this period, we will let you know. So if you were planning on coming, stay tuned. We will let you know when that's going to be. Let's jump in. And Alexei, tell me, how do people tend to present? Let's just kind of start at the beginning. When people have COVID, I mean, certainly there are people who don't have any symptoms, but if people are going to be symptomatic, what do they tend to have and how do they present when we see them in the hospital?
So there is the whole spectrum of how people present, and some of the greatest guidance we've been provided is by our Italian colleagues. And in fact, they have a concept of phenotypes. The document we have is coming from Dr. Stefano Paglia, who is a medical director in Lodi, Milan. And they divide it into various phenotypes, and this is consistent with our early observations in these patients. The least sick patients, they're just febrile, usually no respiratory symptoms, and they generally can be just discharged from the emergency room. And as the disease gets more severe, ERDS or lung inflammatory changes are the most common. So they start becoming more hypoxemic and develop consolidations. And consolidations can be all visualized on chest X-ray, lung ultrasound, or CAT scan. And those patients probably would need to be admitted and observed, because if they do deteriorate, they deteriorate fast.
Yeah. So these are patients who are presenting with upper respiratory symptoms like cough, sore throat, in addition to the fever, sometimes hypoxemia.
And hypoxemia and dyspnea in particular. So one of the ways also to look at them, if they can walk 20 yards or so, right? So if they can walk without developing hypoxemia, they probably safe to be discharged and they would fall into phenotype one. However, if they start developing hypoxemia, they probably may need to be admitted. And okay, especially okay, if they have baseline dyspnea when you just talk to them.
And phenotype one is the people who, as you said, maybe fever, no other symptoms, can go home. How many additional phenotypes are there? Is it just one and two, or do they break down those who are in the hospital into different ones?
Three through five, right? So phenotype five, for example, is ERDS, right?
Okay.
Where all the admitted to critical care and managed correspondingly. Phenotype three is when you start getting hypoxemia and you may need support, right? So originally recommended to have, for example, face mask up to 15 liters of oxygen, whereas we largely start looking into using high-flow nasal cannula in these patients. And the phenotype four is pre-ARDS. So why that scheme is important, it helps place patients in the appropriate location. So according to Italian colleagues, actually, phenotype two is, well, need to be admitted, and it's much more common than the ones who require ICU management. And in fact, they stated that it's about 20 times more common than the ones who need intensive care.
Okay, so phenotype one can go home. Phenotype two needs to be admitted, but probably on the floor. They don't need constant monitoring. Is that right?
That's correct.
And then phenotype three, you said, is now we're getting to need some sort of support, oxygen, maybe even high-flow nasal cannula. Phenotype four is pre-ARDS, and phenotype five is florid ARDS. Okay, so let's talk about when we have someone who we are interacting with who either has confirmed or suspected COVID. We want to be very careful. We need to protect ourselves as healthcare providers. So how are we doing that? What's the appropriate personal protective equipment to wear when interacting with? And let's put intubation aside for a minute. If you're just going in to do, let's say, a physical exam, listen to the heart and lungs on one of these patients, what do you need to be wearing?
So currently, our recommendations, which evolve as we learn more also, is to have either N95 mask with a face shield or a PAPR and extra gown and two pairs of gloves.
Okay.
That's for the regular care of these patients.
And then ideally, we would have an observer, right, so that we can have someone telling us whether we're putting on and taking this stuff off appropriately?
Correct. So the observer would be vital for both donning and doffing. Because largely this is a droplet precautions, however, and the prevention of aerosol generation is the most important thing. So doffing or taking off PPE is actually becomes of utmost importance.
Right. And you said something that I just want to echo, which is that this is constantly changing and getting updated. And so I should have said all the way up front that the caveat for all of this is we're trying to get this information out because it may be helpful for people. But please know that even by the time you listen to this, even if it's just a few hours or days after we record it, things could have changed. So you can take this as an example of where things stand on March 21st, but things will change. And so before you do anything, before you act on anything we're saying here, obviously check with your local infection control folks and your intensivists to make sure that you're both doing what your hospital system wants you to be doing and up to date, because as I said, this is changing very quickly. All right. But for now, Alexei, as you said, we're going to be wearing either an N95 or a PAPR, as well as double gowning, double gloving. Okay. That's just to go in and see these patients. So if this is a tier two, yeah, go ahead.
And a caveat for N95, of course, make sure it's you fit to wear it and wear it with a face shield.
Right. Now, I guess the flip side of this is that for patients who are not suspected to have COVID, we really don't want to be wearing N95s because there is a national shortage. And, you know, I got some emails even just this morning from colleagues at, especially on the West Coast, where they're having to improvise the best they can to come up with something like an N95 because they've already run out. So we do want to conserve them and use them only for what we call PUIs, person under investigation or who may have COVID and then obviously confirm COVID. Is that right? We really want to conserve the respirators for them. And of course, you'd use them where you would have always used them for TB patients, et cetera.
Correct. So when you have a high prevalence in population, anyone can be suspected. However, a patient is completely asymptomatic with no respiratory symptoms. Regular mask and possibly face shield is more than enough at this point. Once they start having respiratory symptoms, then adding protective gear becomes important.
Okay. So we talked about phenotype 1. They're going to go home. Phenotype 2, you have in the hospital. When you're interacting with them, you need to use this equipment, but we're hoping they'll be okay even without any supplemental oxygen. Now we get into phenotype 3. They need support. So they're going to be presumably on either an IMC level floor or in an ICU or, I guess, a floor where they can get monitoring and supplemental oxygen. Is that right?
That's correct.
Now, same thing in terms of being careful with these patients, but some things we might do normally that we're at least changing, right? So let's say that one of these patients has bronchospasm. We're not going to do nebulizers, right, in these patients?
The preference is to use MDIs. The issue is becoming now there is a national shortage in MDIs.
And an MDI is a meter dose inhaler, right? So this is the thing that people walk around with and take a puff on their own.
Correct. The good thing that in general they do not usually require albuterol atrovent, the bronchodilating medications. However, if they have underlying COPD, that is definitely a consideration, and special measures should be taken to deliver those medications. And in fact, we advocate to have very strict criteria on using bronchodilating medications in this patient.
Okay. So avoid if possible. If you have to do it, use an MDI meter dose inhaler if you can. And if you absolutely have no choice and have to do a nebulized treatment, then you really need to take some extra precautions.
Correct. With the underlying principle of really minimizing aerosolizing the virus, if trying to use closed systems, it becomes a little bit different when someone is intubated versus non-intubated. And for non-intubated patients, it's we advocate to try to minimize to none.
Right. And then the same would go for anything that could aerosolize. So we really want to try to avoid bronchoscopies on these people. Anything else that we would normally maybe consider on someone having respiratory distress that we wouldn't do in these patients?
So we're minimizing also use of CPAP and BiPAP unless you have good system of filtering the exhaled air, because the flows are extremely high, so aerosolization potential is very high.
Right.
Even if you have a filter, there is still a problem of proper mask fitting. So you have to fulfill both of those conditions to perform it safely. However, it may be only rescue therapy and that may be the only choice. Then again, wearing PPE becomes of utmost importance.
Right. Now, I know in Europe they're using helmet CPAP, which is a way that you can do CPAP and still have a closed system for the exhaled air. We don't have that available here as far as I know. Are you aware of any talk about trying to get a hold of those or use them or not?
So they are not approved currently. So, I mean, people definitely are looking into that or have an expedited approval as a backup therapy to our current therapies.
Okay. So for our patients now, we have, if they need oxygen, we're going to give them a nasal cannula. And that can go all the way up. You said we'll even go as high as 15, although often we feel like that, you know, may dry out the nasal passages a little too much, but we go basically regular nasal cannula, you can try. Then if they're still hypoxemic on maximal standard nasal cannula treatment, we're not going to do BiPAP and CPAP, as you said, unless it's, you know, just really an absolute last resort. So we're going to go to high flow nasal cannula. If we're doing high flow nasal cannula, any idea? Do we go higher flow, higher FiO2, both? Is there any difference between managing these patients on a high-flow nasal cannula versus a standard hypoxemic patient?
So currently we recommend to use a regular surgical face mask over high-flow cannula, also to minimize aerosolization of the virus. And second thing, we have established trigger somewhere in the range of 40 liters per minute flow, and 40 to 50% of oxygen is a trigger for medicine to start activating airway teams. And the intensivist who is on call 24/7 currently to initiate discussions on intubating those patients.
All right. So we're going to go ahead and dial up the FiO2 and the flow. But when we hit certain triggers, so you said 30 to 40 liters of flow, and how much FiO2?
40 to 50.
So so still fairly low. So in other words, you're starting early. You don't want to let these patients max out at 100% FiO2 and 60 liters of flow and then start thinking about intubation. Is that right?
Correct. It's the idea behind this is to prevent uncontrolled situation if intubation is required. And secondary, I mean, by calculation, the PF ratio at those rates and FiO2 is going to be close to 200, which is start hitting the ARDS range.
Right. Okay. So we have a high-flow nasal cannula with a mask over it, as you said, and just a surgical mask to try to prevent some of the aerosolization. And then fairly early, if that's not cutting it, if we're ramping that up, we're going to go ahead and move to intubation. Now, obviously, this is a high-risk procedure in these patients. Some of this is starting early with the planning, like you said, so that we don't end up with a panicked stat intubation. What are we doing differently in terms of our personal protective equipment when we're intubating these patients as opposed to just going in to do an exam?
So unlike regular exam in this situation, PAPR is the preferred modality. If we do run out of PAPRs, where N95 mask with a face shield is the second choice. Person would wear two gowns and three pair of gloves.
Okay, so three pairs of gloves because one is going to come off immediately after the tube goes in and wrap around the laryngoscope. And then you've still got two on, which you would always have two on when you are in these rooms. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay, so you've got your ideally your PAPR or an N95 and a face shield. You've got your double gowns, your triple gloves. All right, and you've got your observer to make sure you're doing it right. So you're going to get everything together. What else do we want to keep in mind as we're getting ready to intubate these patients?
So the way the system works, the medicine service activates the intensivist on call, and Hulu may dispatch the airway team to intubate the patient early. And in preparation, there is another person to support intubation. There is an RT in the room, and there is a nurse in the room. The other communication that happens, medicine team would prepare actually norepinephrine to hemodynamically support the patient as well as sedation. So this is just in preparation for that. You know, all the equipment has to be assembled ahead of time, because one caveat when you put a Dawn PAPR on, communication between providers is somewhat limited because of the airflow within the hood.
Right. So we're going to have everything ready. We're going to have our team ready to go in. Once we've decided on a plan, we're going to go in. And then what about the approach to intubation? We're doing RSIs in these patients for the most part?
So preference is to use video laryngoscopy, and the preference is to do RSI in these patients. So again, the idea is the same as for any airway interventions, is to prevent aerosols entering the air.
Right. So we're going to limit or try to avoid mask ventilation completely, which for a lot of people I think have been moving towards, especially in ICU intubations after the trial that was published in the New England Journal, to try to consider doing, even for RSIs, doing some mask ventilation. But with these patients, we really are going to try to minimize or eliminate that. We are going to try to get that tube in as quickly as possible, like you said, to eliminate or minimize the time where virus can be aerosolized.
And because we're advocating really for relatively early intubation, we will have time to pre-oxygenate the person adequately. Usually we would use face mask attached to AmbuVac without any positive pressure supported breaths, right, and give them good lead time to do that. The main thing is that you need lots of time to prepare adequately, protect yourself, and plan how you intubate the patient.
Right. And are we using video laryngoscopy because we just want to maximize the success rate and we think that that's a little better, or is there another reason?
It's a maximized success rate, as well as you have more direct confirmation of where the tube goes in, which depending on the environment, it may serve actually as a confirmation that the tube is in the airway.
Right, as opposed to having to contaminate a stethoscope.
And stethoscope in itself is a little bit difficult to use with paper mask. So
right.
What we've been using is a combination of visualization where the tube goes in, as well as lung ultrasound to see if there is bilateral lung sliding.
Great.
With combination of those two, we can more or less precisely say where the tube is. The thing is, if we do decide to confirm it with the entitled CO2, we may end up using colorimetric, and if we do so, we usually would clamp the tube. So, in fact, if we have to have planned the disconnections of the circuit, there is no escape of aerosol from the patient.
Right. Okay. So what about a viral filter when we're trying to avoid mask ventilation? Are we putting a viral filter on the end of the mask if just for the breathing, just for the pre-oxygenation, or are we doing that only if we have decided to mask ventilate?
No, we put it in line all along. So if we do need to ventilate the patient, it's already in place. So
okay.
Those filters are readily available through our respiratory care.
Okay. So you mentioned disconnects. So let's say we get the endotracheal tube in, we secure it, and we realize, oh, you know, we forgot to put inline suction in and we want that, or we forgot our hookup for our end-tidal CO2. If we have to disconnect a patient who's connected, we obviously, as you alluded to, don't want to just leave the endotracheal tube open to spew virus out into the room. So you mentioned clamping. So we're going to, anytime we have to disconnect the patient, we're going to clamp the tube itself. Is that right?
Endotracheal tube you use in surgical clamp.
Okay. And are we wrapping it with some gauze to try to avoid damage to the tube?
Correct.
Okay. So we're going to wrap some gauze, put a surgical clamp on it. Now, obviously, if the patient really tries to breathe hard against that closed tube, we could end up with some complications like negative pressure pulmonary edema, but we're thinking that we're going to do this quickly and hopefully avoid that.
That is correct. But also during intubation with adequate muscle relaxation, there is sufficient lead time to do those maneuvers.
Right. Okay. So if we're using, and are we preferentially using ROC or rocuronium or succinylcholine, or it doesn't matter?
Present, we use succinylcholine because based on the human behavior, sometimes people just don't have enough patience to wait. And succinylcholine provides a relatively visual confirmation that patient is adequately relaxed, because inadequate relaxation can actually lead to more coughing and fighting the intubation and, again, spewing the virus into the room environment.
Okay. So if we need to disconnect, we're going to clamp. And then the other thing is obviously the other end, right? So if you disconnect, if you leave the ventilator running, then virus that was circulating in that circuit is now going to get pumped out into the room, right? So you also want to make sure to turn the vent off.
Correct. And this is the reason to have the respiratory therapist in the room.
Okay. So let's go back to our patient. We've now, early on, we went to high-flow nasal cannula. Then that was escalating our flow in our FiO2. So we said, we're not going to wait. We're going to move to intubation. We got our intubation equipment ready. We went in with our appropriate PPE, and we placed the endotracheal tube and hooked them up to the circuit. In my prior podcast that I did with the folks from Penn in Italy, we talked about early nutrition in these people. So probably when you're putting in an endotracheal tube, you're going to want to put in an OG tube as well. Is that something that we're trying to do at the same time, or is that happening later?
It happens pretty much simultaneously because we're strongly advocating for early nutrition in these patients.
Okay. So we've got the tube in. What kind of settings are we doing here? What kind of vent management are we putting in place?
So vent management follows ARDS network guidelines for protective lung ventilation.
So we're going to try to keep 6 cc's per kilo of ideal body weight. We are going to try to keep plateau pressures less than 30. What kind of PEEP are we using with these patients?
So not infrequently, these patients need higher PEEP, but despite that, their compliance remains relatively well-preserved.
Okay, so we think that part of this disease process is loss of surfactant from damage to type 2 pneumocytes from this virus attacking them, and so that would make sense that PEEP, to keep those airways that may struggle to remain open, would be helpful. Are we using a specific kind of guided table to match FiO2 with PEEP? Are we calculating driving pressure and adjusting PEEP to maximize or to minimize driving pressure? How are we doing that?
So talking to our medicine colleagues, the preference is still to use FiO2 and PEEP table provided by ARDS network. And as we learn more, we may choose the scale that advocates for higher PEEP. Currently, though, we're still going to be following the ARDS network provided table.
Okay, so that's the kind of what a lot of people refer to as standard PEEP. And then there's also this other one you mentioned, kind of the high PEEP, which would have higher PEEP for a given level of FiO2. But for us, at least so far, we're sticking to the standard PEEP. And then maybe there's some leeway around looking at driving pressure and raising PEEP a little to see if that lowers the driving pressure.
And that's correct. I mean, we advocate to have driving pressure, which is plateau pressure minus PEEP, to less than 14 centimeters of water.
Right. And so we've done some episodes on this, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. But obviously, if you have a plateau pressure, just to make this easy, if you have a plateau pressure of 30 and a PEEP of 10, then your driving pressure is 20. If you went up to a PEEP of 12 and your plateau pressure didn't change, you now have a plateau pressure of 30 and a PEEP of 12, well, then your driving pressure has come down to 18, and so that's a good change. And so sometimes going up on PEEP can reduce your driving pressure without affecting your plateau pressure, and that would be, we would think, a good change. Does that make sense?
That totally makes sense.
All right. So you mentioned before that we're using ultrasound to take a look at the lungs. It can be helpful to confirm endotracheal tube placement. Certainly, you can get a feel for the consolidations. You also, I think before we started recording, you mentioned to me also taking a look at the hearts on these patients. And obviously, one thing we're hearing in reports from China and Italy and other places is that sometimes these patients are getting some significant cardiomyopathy, even ending up with cardiac arrest, maybe even after they started recovering from a respiratory standpoint. So are you screening these patients for any signs of cardiomyopathy, or are you waiting for other symptoms that might clue you in that you need to take a look at the heart? How are we approaching that?
So at present, we're actually sending troponin level in this patient as part of screening. It doesn't have to be daily. We also advocate if you are using ultrasound for any other reason, for example, for procedural support, can place ultrasound at least into subcostal position and visualize what's happening with the heart, because so far we've seen that patients start developing pericarditis early, and definitely based on reported experiences with myocarditis with reduced ejection fraction can be a later complication.
Okay. So that makes a lot of sense to keep an eye on it. So let me back up a second to the vent management here. So ARDS management. Now, these patients are potentially, I think, often very with it, right? I mean, they've got hypoxemia, but they don't have anything affecting their brain necessarily. And so, these are not patients who are going to probably like a mandatory volume control ventilation mode without sedation. So are we sedating them to keep them on volume control? Are we putting them on pressure support and watching their tidal volumes? What's the approach here?
So general approach, once you reach the levels of more aggressive support in terms of low, because of the demand, low PF ratio, we do sedate them, and we do AC, and proning has been vital. Actually, patients would be prone for extended periods of time.
Okay, so proning, obviously that means taking someone instead of on their back, putting them on their belly with the endotracheal tube in place, and that can be for the entire day? Is there a mandatory amount of time? How long are we leaving people prone?
And I'm being a minion for a long period of time is 18 to 24 hours.
Okay. So people can remain prone for essentially the whole day if it's working. If you flip them back on their back and they get profoundly worse, then you would potentially go back to prone.
Potentially, if it's a life-threatening hypoxemia. Alternatively, again, to minimize aerosolation and not deliver inhaled bronchodilators, something like prostaglandins, use of nitric oxide can be tried, although not necessarily always effective.
Okay, so nitric oxide in severe hypoxemia is a possibility. We're not using inhaled Valitri because of the concern for aerosolization. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. So let's say you have a patient severely hypoxemic. They're intubated. As you said, we're going to try proning. Other things, what about neuromuscular blockers?
So neuromuscular blockers are in the same line as pronin. They definitely can be considered if, despite those maneuvers, patients still have substantial dyssynchrony or if hypoxemia remains refractory.
Okay. Now, we have a patient who is severely hypoxemic, maybe some neuromuscular blockade, in which case they clearly need sedation. Even if they're not being paralyzed with neuromuscular blockade, they still, in order to keep them compliant on the vent, not double taking double breaths, not breath stacking, are going to, as you said, need sedation. If they're getting sedation, probably with propofol, then they're probably also going to need, or at least very likely may need, some vasopressor support because of the vasodilation from the propofol. So I assume that a lot of these patients are intubated on a propofol drip and probably a levofed drip, norepinephrine drip. Is that right?
That's probably not an infrequent finding in these patients. Okay. And one thing I would like to add about pronin, we do not view pronin as a salvage maneuver. We actually view it as a lung protective maneuver and advocate for early utilization of this.
Okay, right. So this is not, yeah, I think you're exactly right that some people think of this as you've done everything else. You're kind of, the patient is you know, desatting to a dangerous point on full maximum treatment, and then the salvage is to try proning. But as you say, we really want this to be part of the standard treatment. Okay, you mentioned to me before that we're seeing some hypercoagulability in these patients. Tell me a little about that.
So there are reports now coming out of other countries' experience that pulmonary embolism may be a big problem in this and one of the causes of mortality. In some patients, where Italians in particular report high levels of D-dimer, and in several patients now, there are reports of hyperfibrinogenemia, so high fibrinogen. Pardon my tongue being
twisted.
Twisted. And one of the patients we looked at here sent a thromboelastogram, which also completes the hypercoagulable profile. So the interesting question is how aggressive we should be with anticoagulating those. And some of the Italian colleagues actually advocate for full heparinization of those patients. Not sure how much evidence-based data supports that, but anecdotally, that may be actually a beneficial intervention in these patients. And aggressive DVT prophylaxis is a great consideration in this patient population.
Okay, yeah. So it's just like nutrition, got to be on top of that, got to be on top of the DVT prophylaxis. So that's really important to know. It'll be interesting to see as more data comes out from other countries that are a little ahead of us in terms of the time course, whether that's a trend that continues. So let's talk about the and hopefully we're not seeing this often, but if we do have to do CPR, if we have a cardiac arrest and we have to do CPR in these patients, are we altering the traditional CPR algorithm in any way?
The answer is yes. In a way, more so for in-hospital. But it's still algorithm is still in compliance with the out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. So chest compressions take a priority over everything else. And again, with the idea to minimize viral spread, chest compressions are performed by the first responder until the second responder is available and can rotate. And patient may receive free-flowing oxygen via face mask initially until intubating team is able to actually place the endotracheal tube.
Okay. So the big difference is normally in in-hospital cardiac arrest, we would give breaths along with chest compressions. But with these patients, we're not doing the breaths, just trying to get that breathing tube in as quickly as possible to have a closed circuit. Okay.
And then we do emphasize that all providers respondents should be in PPE for that. So if arrest, for example, happens while provider is outside of the room, the provider still has to put in PPE.
Right. And I think we've recently gone to considering all codes and rapid response calls in our hospital. We're going to assume are COVID suspected. So even if the patient wasn't before having an arrest or before being, you know, having whatever happened that causes the rapid response to be called, we're going to assume that they should be treated as if they are a COVID rule out. In other words, if we get called to a room on a floor, patient was not being suspected for COVID, but now they've gotten, you know, severely hypoxemic or they've had a cardiac arrest and they need to be intubated, we're going to do it as if they were a COVID patient, right? We're going to use a appropriate either a PAP or N95 with a face mask.
That is correct.
Okay. So let's talk briefly about treatments. And this is probably, you know, the biggest question mark. We just don't know yet. But I think people are hearing a lot of things about, you know, hydroxychloroquine, about convalescent serum, about steroids. I think steroids are the easy one, right? We know that steroids don't work in these patients.
That's our agreement here, that in fact, they may be harmful in viral pneumonias.
Right. So we're not giving steroids. What about hydroxychloroquine? Is that something that is being investigated? Is it being used? What do we know about it?
So we know from reports and small studies, usually in not randomized, not large volume studies, that they may decrease viral shedding or shorten time to viral shedding. At this point, we're still not recommending it for our patients. However, we have a close eye on the evolving literature and follow it closely. Okay. And there are discussions on the case-by-case basis because our infectious disease specialists have greater experience and greater grasp also on the totality of literature at this point. We strongly advocate to involve them in the shared decision making.
Okay. So basically, we don't have a lot of great treatments other than supportive care yet. Obviously, a lot of work being done. People are working on vaccines. People are trying different antivirals. So that will be something that's rapidly changing. How long do these patients tend to need support? It's a while, right? We're not talking about a kind of a couple day acute period, right? We're looking at kind of many days to weeks of needing to be on a ventilator.
Based on the reports from my Chinese colleagues, it appears that 2 to 3 weeks is the expected time to have those patients on the ventilator support.
Okay. And are they getting trached at all? Are they getting tracheostomies or no? They're just remaining with a standard endotracheal tube.
That is a good question. So to which we at this point don't have a good answer. We have discussions both ways. I mean, if you're predicting that the patients will remain in the ventilator for extended period of time, maybe early tracheostomy is beneficial. However, it's a high aerosol-generating procedure. So we're in close discussions with our surgical colleagues at this point. Definitely, we're not going to start discussions until at least 2 weeks on the ventilator at this point.
Okay. And ECMO, we're kind of taking on a case-by-case basis. We haven't ruled it out for these patients completely, but certainly don't have the ability to put every severe COVID patient on an ECMO circuit. Is that right?
It's on case-by-case basis following the guidelines.
Okay. Well, Alexei, this has been an incredibly informative discussion. Is there anything we didn't touch on that you think is important to get across?
I think that's pretty much it.
Great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time. I know you're very busy. Thanks for all you're doing, and I appreciate you coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you, Jed.
All right. Hopefully that was useful. This is a protocol that is constantly in flux, but it's what we're using for now and hopefully will be helpful to folks out there trying to develop your own protocols. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com. You can leave a comment and others can learn from you. So let us know what you're doing, how you're improvising, how you are developing protocols. Also, you can join the conversation on Twitter. I'm at Jay Wolpaw and we're at ACRAC Podcast. And of course, there's a Facebook group for ACRAC as well. Let us know if you're a fan of the show. You can go to iTunes and leave a comment and a rating. And that also helps others find the show. If you are a fan of the show, you can go to patreon.com/ACRAC or leave a donation at paypal.me/ACRAC. Thanks so much to those who have done that already. It really makes a big difference. And of course, a huge thank you to Kimmy Akash Cooley, our intern, and to Dr. Brian Park and April Liu, who are making great outlines for some of the episodes. And a big thank you to Dr. Dennis Kuo, who composed the original ACRAC music that you hear at the beginning and end of every episode. And you can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right. The biggest thank you, of course, goes to all of you who are out there dealing with this every day on the front lines. Hang in there, stay healthy, stay safe. Thanks for listening. For the ACRAC Podcast and Dr. Alexei Pustovoitow, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.